Hi, and thanks for joining me for Stories from the Phoenix New Times. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer, Chip Hawbrook. First on this week's program, not on our side, ASU group protests after foreign students lose visas. This story was written by Morgan Fisher and was posted on the Phoenix New Times website on April 4th. Thursday afternoon in Tempe, a handful of Arizona State University students gathered around a large white sheet laid out on the green grass of Hayden Lawn. All members of the group Students for Justice in Palestine at ASU squeezed paint onto paper plates and began painting a banner before walking it through campus and hanging it over a pedestrian bridge. A day earlier, AZ Luminaria reported that the U.S. State Department has revoked the visas of 8 international students at ASU. The news came amid a months-long crackdown on immigrants under President Donald Trump, during which immigration authorities have yanked visas and detained and deported immigrants with spacious justifications. Some have been detained over spurious connections to the Venezuelan gang Tren de Aragua. Others, including many university students, have found themselves arrested by U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement over criticism of Israel's war in Gaza. SJP had already been planning a Thursday protest when the AZ Luminaria's report dropped. It quickly shifted its focus to call attention to the paranoia and fear percolating throughout ASU's campus. "It's not a safe space on campus for students," said SPG co-chair Sophie Levitt, a 22-year-old senior majoring in justice studies. "That's what the ASU charter itself proclaims ASU was supposed to be. It goes against its very own mission, essentially, when it's creating this unsafe environment for its students." The school's 46-word charter, written on slabs of granite placed throughout the university's 4 campuses, reads in part, "ASU is a comprehensive public research university, measured not by whom it excludes, but by whom it includes." ASU has acknowledged the visa revocations, but has given few details about the students affected. In a statement to New Times, ASU spokesperson Jerry Gonzalez stated that federal authorities have revoked visas for at least 8 students, but that ASU couldn't provide an exact number due to the complexity of the visa process. Gonzalez said that the revocations are unrelated campus protests and stem from what appear to be, in most cases, various legal infractions. In a statement to AZ Luminaria, ASU asserted that none of the 8 foreign students to lose visas are from Latin American countries. That explanation doesn't go far for SJP members. "We can't trust them," said 21-year-old member Michaela, who asked that her last name be withheld. "They've made it very clear that we can't trust them, and they're not on our side." "They are not giving us clear answers," Levitt added. Highly unusual. Whatever the reason for pulling the students' visas, immigration attorneys and advocates in Arizona say doing so is highly unusual. Immigration lawyer Salvador Macias of Nunez Law Group says that he's not once dealt with or heard of an individual who had their student visa revoked, at least not before Trump took office for the second time earlier this year. Francisco Aguirre, the founder and CEO of Beyond Attorneys, said the same. "I have never heard of a student visa being revoked," Aguirre said. "Visas are typically revoked if the holder violates its terms in some way," Macias said. "For students, this could mean they started working in an area outside of their field or that they committed a serious crime. More recently, under Trump, it's meant that an international student expressed an opinion that the current administration doesn't like." In what Macias called an unprecedented step, Secretary of State Marco Rubio has directed the department to look into anyone who has a visa to find a pretext for deporting them. If you think that they performed an act that we now classify as terrorism or against the interest of the United States, we will be revoking it, Macias said. If visa holders protested against the war in Gaza, posted something on social media, or even just shared an op-ed or news article online that's not in line with the administration's, they could lose their visas. The administration is not batting an eye in terms of revoking on something as little as even their social media accounts, Macias said. If this smells funky to you, you're not alone. The Trump administration has been detaining and deporting people by citing fishy authority, including that having tattoos and being Venezuelan is enough to identify a person as a member of Tren de Aragua. Additionally, the Trump administration has cited the Alien Enemies Act of 1798, which allows for the immediate removal of foreign nationals during wartime, to deport alleged Latin American gang members that the administration claims have, quote, invaded the United States. Many people deported under that law have been shipped to an infamously brutal prison in El Salvador, where they have been unable to speak with their families or contest their arrests. Federal courts have nonetheless ruled against the administration's practices, halting deportation flights to El Salvador and barring immigration authorities from detaining specific people. But courts move slowly, and immigrant communities are still fearful. This administration is coming up with very creative ways to remove individuals, Macias said, adding that it's happening so quickly and so erratically without deep legal research that ICE officers don't know why they're doing what they're doing. ICE has not been present on ASU's campus, according to the university, although the school previously told the Arizona Republic the opposite. ASU walked back that statement, which Gonzalez said was based on some rumors that later proved not to be true. Still, Levitt and others with SJP are acutely aware that the university administration or the cameras on top of Hayden Library are watching them and other students. They are all American citizens and should have little to fear from ICE, though immigration authorities have ensnared citizens in their sweeps already. They've been careful to protect members of the student population whose presence in the country is more tenuous, especially now. I have a certain privilege being a resident here in Arizona, being a citizen, said Levitt. I feel a bit more comfortable pushing the boundaries, but I know that so many people are unable to do the same thing, because if they do, they're risking deportation. They're risking their visas being revoked. Next, a story written by Gloria Rebecca Gomez of the Arizona Mirror and posted on the New Times website on April 3rd. Immigrant group sues to strike down Arizona's Secure the Border Act. An immigrant rights group is asking the courts to overturn the Secure Border Act, the ballot measure voters overwhelmingly approved last year that made it a state crime for migrants to illegally cross the Arizona-Mexico border, because it violates a provision in the state constitution that voters approved more than 20 years ago. Living United for Change in Arizona, a progressive organization that was among the most vocal critics of the act while it was being considered by lawmakers last year, filed a lawsuit in Maricopa County Superior Court Wednesday, arguing that the sweeping anti-immigrant law should be struck down because it violates funding source protections in the Arizona Constitution. Standing in front of the court on Wednesday afternoon, just hours after the lawsuit was filed, Alejandra Gomez, Lucha's executive director, denounced it as a resurrection of SB 1070. The state's notorious Show Me Your Papers law that gave police officers permission to investigate a person's legal status during routine traffic stops. We remember SB 1070, she said. We remember what happened when politicians played politics with our dignity and safety. We are taking this fight to the courts because our families, our rights, and our futures are on the line. Voters last year sided with the GOP lawmakers who crafted the Secure Border Act and sent it to the ballot, with 63% of votes in favor of Proposition 314. The law makes it a misdemeanor to cross the state's southern border without authorization anywhere but at an official port of entry, which could carry with it up to 6 months in jail. Local police officers would be empowered to arrest migrants suspected of violating that law, and state judges would be able to issue deportation orders. While that provision is frozen until the U.S. Supreme Court rules on a near-identical law in Texas, other parts of it are active, including making it a Class 6 felony to use false documentation to apply for benefits or jobs, and creating an entirely new class of felony for people convicted of selling fentanyl that later results in someone else's death. The problem with the initiative, according to LUCA attorney Jim Barton, is that the Arizona Constitution requires ballot measures that result in any government spending to identify a funding source, and that money can't come from Arizona's general fund. That constitutional provision dates back to 2004, when Republican lawmakers sought to prevent advocacy groups from going to the ballot to force the state government to pay for programs that the GOP majority didn't want. But the constitutional restriction applies also to measures sent to the ballot by the legislature. When lawmakers last year were considering the Secure Border Act, multiple law enforcement officials traveled to the Capitol to warn that they would need more resources to enforce its directives. But lawmakers still failed to set aside a funding stream, something the Arizona Mirror exclusively reported on. That, Barton said, nullifies the initiative. Because Proposition 314 will cost millions of dollars and it has no funding source, it's unconstitutional and unenforceable, he said. In Texas, more than $11 billion of taxpayer money has been set aside to fund the Lone Star State's restrictive border policies. Although the provision in Proposition 314, making it a state crime to cross the border without permission, is likely the one with the biggest price tag, the other parts that are being implemented also cost money. In that brief, Barton pointed out that the act requires state agencies to double-check a person's eligibility for public benefits through a federal database if they are a non-citizen, even if they have legal status. That database, called the Systematic Alien Verification for Entitlements, charges individual agencies a $25 monthly fee and a separate fee for each inquiry. That per-inquiry fee is currently $1.50, but will incrementally increase in the coming years until it hits $3.50 by 2028. Several state agencies already use SAVE, including the Department of Health Services, to verify eligibility for access, and the Department of Economic Security, to make sure applicants are eligible for food stamps or cash assistance. But Barton told the Arizona Mirror that the Secure the Border Act threatens to impact a host of new public benefits, including library cards. Legislature chose to lie. During Wednesday's news conference, Barton also noted that lawmakers had ample notice about the potential economic hit of the Save the Border Act. While it was still being drafted, the Joint Legislative Budget Committee released a fiscal impact report that estimated it would cost state and local law enforcement as much as $41 million every year to make arrests and transport people with orders of deportation to a port of entry. And the Arizona Department of Corrections, Rehabilitation, and Reentry, which would be required under the act to house people accused of illegally crossing the border if local law enforcement agencies didn't have the capacity to, could see costs of up to $178 million. The nonpartisan Grand Canyon Institute, meanwhile, projected the total annual cost at $325 million if the provision giving the state the power to enforce federal immigration is made effective. But, Barton said, while GOP lawmakers knew about the costs, the Arizonans who voted to approve the Secure the Border Act were never given the opportunity to consider that drawback. The legislature chose to lie to the voters and hide the cost of this measure when they presented it to the voters, Barton said. Luckily, in the state of Arizona, that is unconstitutional. It is unconstitutional to ask voters to pass legislation without identifying the funding source when it costs money. When faced with questions about the costs, GOP lawmakers last year repeatedly waved away the concerns, saying they would figure that out later, or that it would pay for itself by saving the state vast sums because the rate of illegal immigration is even more expensive than any costs that could be incurred by enforcing federal immigration laws. In the lawsuit, Luca lambasted that reasoning, with Barton writing that nowhere in the revenue source rule is any exception made for funding sources established after the fact or for hypothetical offsets. Senate President Warren Peterson, who helped write the Secure the Border Act and shepherded it through the legislature, did not respond to requests for comment on the lawsuit. Kim Quintero, a spokeswoman for Peterson and Senate Republicans, said that he was not willing to speak on the issue until he's able to review the lawsuit himself. Follow-up questions about whether Peterson believes that the act complies with the revenue source rule went unanswered. Not the first challenge. This isn't the first time Luca and Barton have sought to void Prop 314. Before the initiative was placed on the ballot last year, the group attempted to convince the courts that, because it spans so many different parts of Arizona law, it violated the state constitution's single subject rule. But that challenge failed, with the Arizona Supreme Court agreeing with Republican lawmakers, who argued that all of the Act's provisions fall under the overarching theme of border security. But this lawsuit is different, Barton said, because the Arizona Constitution is very clear about funding sources, and it isn't open for interpretation. I don't see any wiggle room here, he said. The law says you have to provide funding for mandatory expenditures. This mandates expenditures, and it doesn't provide a source. And that earlier loss in court will also aid Luca. Barton noted that the courts have already concluded that all the provisions in Prop 314 deal with just one subject, meaning that Republicans won't be able to argue that just one part should be struck down. So if any of it is judged to be in violation of the Arizona Constitution, the whole act will have to be nullified. Along with arguing that Prop 314 is unconstitutional because it fails to provide money to pay for it, Luca is also claiming that it violates two other legal principles enshrined in the state constitution, which govern how lawmakers make policy and to what degree government branches can encroach on each other's responsibilities. One of them, which is included in the Arizona Constitution, is the separation of powers. Barton said that a provision in Prop 314 defining probable cause for officers who arrest migrants infringes on the judicial branch's authority. That provision was added by GOP lawmakers after public outcry from immigrant rights groups and criticism from Democrats that it would result in discriminatory policing. It states that an arrest under the new law may only be made if an officer witnesses a person crossing the border unlawfully, there is a video recording of the event, or there are, quote, other constitutionally sufficient indicia of probable cause. In the lawsuit, Barton argues that lawmakers have no authority to define what probable cause is, because that's the court's job, and they've already done it. In 1974, the Arizona Supreme Court ruled that probable cause is when an arresting officer has reasonably trustworthy information of facts and circumstances, which lead them to a reasonable inference that a crime is being committed, that a specific person is committing or has committed it, and that a reasonable person would believe the same. The Arizona legislature's decision to write a different definition of probable cause amounts to lawmakers seeking to take over a judicial function, according to Barton. Barton also claimed that Republicans committed an unlawful delegation of legislative authority by making the effectiveness of the Secure the Border Act dependent on the outcome of a case against a near identical law in Texas. That law, SB 4, was challenged in federal court by the Biden administration and remains tied up in litigation. The Arizona iteration is on hold until the Texas version or similar laws in other states are allowed to go into effect. Putting the enforcement of Arizona laws into the hands of other states, where Arizona has no input into their legal strategy, is unconstitutional, Barton said. The Arizona legislature gave our lawmaking over to the Texas legislature and said, well, once Texas gets their law through, then and only then will our law take effect, he said. You can't do that. The Arizona legislature has the responsibility to make laws for the state of Arizona. Phoenix school board president bailed out cafe owner after child sex sting. The story was written by Morgan Fisher and posted on April 3rd. On March 26th, Xanadu coffee owner Randall Denton was sentenced to a year in prison for attempting to have sex with a girl he'd been led to believe was 14. In the days since that bomb dropped, everything and everyone around him has felt the shockwaves. Xanadu Coffee closed. Employees said they'd been unaware of the nature of Denton's crime. A few days later, it reopened, though its prospects for survival are uncertain. People have inundated the shop's social media accounts with vitriol. Several employees quit. Valley coffee shops that bought roasted beans from Xanadu have scrambled to find new suppliers. The shockwaves have gone as far as Phoenix Elementary School District No. 1. The district's governing board president is Jessica Bueno, a longtime associate of Denton's. And though she hasn't been directly involved with Xanadu since 2022, public records show that she bailed Denton out of jail following his 2024 arrest, using her house as collateral. Considering her prominent role in a 14-school district near Xanadu that serves more than 5,500 children from preschool through 8th grade, her move caught parents' attention. But in an interview with Phoenix New Times, Bueno said that she was only trying to help a friend and that she hadn't considered the political effect of doing so. I am still a human, and I'm still going to show up authentically as myself, and that is someone who is always going to help their friends, said Bueno, who was first elected to the governing board in 2020 and became its president in 2023. I've known Randy for a while, and I do believe that he is a good person and has good character. And so, to me, it was helping out a friend in need. Bueno said she met Denton in 2016, when Small Matters, a nonprofit Bueno worked for, put on a workshop for small business owners at Denton's former roastery. They quickly connected as Bueno, a self-proclaimed coffee snob, has always been an admirer of coffee. Through the nonprofit, Bueno helped Denton begin selling beans at farmers markets and training people to roast coffee. With a background in accounting, Bueno became the accounts manager of Xanadu Coffee Company in 2017. In October 2020, she and Denton opened Xanadu's cafe on 7th Street in downtown Phoenix. She left Xanadu in 2022, citing priorities with the governing board, her nonprofit job, and unhappiness with the business, but she and Denton remained friends. Bueno said that was the state of things when Denton called her from his jail cell after his arrest and surprise. Though Bueno initially missed the call, she tracked Denton down and bailed him out. A deed of trust on file with the Maricopa County Recorder's Office shows that she paid $12,500 with her downtown Phoenix home as collateral. When she saw Denton's charges, which were then listed as solicitation of a minor, I immediately thought, oh, he got set up, which she added is essentially what happened. Indeed, there was no actual 14-year-old communicating with Denton, who'd actually been corresponding with an undercover cop. But that's the extent of what I knew the charges were, Bueno said. It's not clear exactly how much Bueno knew. Xanadu staffers said they weren't aware of some of the specifics of Denton's arrest, including that he was told the girl was 14 and still decided to pursue her until his sentencing. Bueno said her conversation with Denton after his arrest mainly consisted of making sure that he was following the court's rules. If Denton didn't make the required check-ins, that would have jeopardized my house, she said. Otherwise, she said, Denton and Bueno have talked sporadically over the last year, mostly with her checking on him about his emotional state. Deacon Batchelor, a longtime friend of Denton's and a former lead roaster of Xanadu's wholesaling business, said that after Denton's arrest, Bueno spoke with Xanadu's coffee shop employees about what happened to straighten things out. Bueno said that she doesn't recall addressing the whole staff, but she did work with different staffers to navigate the situation. She should resign. When she bailed Denton out last March, Bueno was in her third year on the governing board and 7 months into her tenure as president. Yet the political consequences of that decision never crossed my mind, Bueno said. Instead, Bueno described her decision to bail out Denton as more of me being caught in the whirlwind of helping a friend. More than a year later, Bueno looks back at her decision with regret. I wasn't in the right frame of mind, and I understand that now, she said. I didn't, in retrospect, reflect on what it could mean for me, or how serious these charges are, and what his actions really were. Bueno's connection to Denton and her role in bailing him out of jail has left many district parents feeling irate and concerned about the safety of their children. That's a pretty big step for a former business partner who is no longer involved, supposedly, to be putting their house on the line for someone accused of a crime like that, said Paula Booth, whose 4-year-old son attends Faith North Elementary School's preschool. We deserve to know what's going on with our school board, some transparency. Angelica Luna, whose 7-year-old son is in the second grade at May Bartlett Heard School, wrote to New Times that she's beyond angry. As a parent and volunteer, I do not want her anywhere near children, Luna wrote. This whole situation is incredibly shady. Booth and Luna both pointed to a photo that Bueno posted to her campaign's Instagram account, which is now set to private, in August 2024. In it, more than 40 people pose with campaign signs, with Denton in the back row in a black collared shirt. Bueno said that the photo was taken in February of 2024, a month before Denton's arrest. District spokesperson Nicole Baker said Bueno informed District Superintendent Deborah Gonzalez last week that she had bailed Denton out of jail. We want to assure our families, staff, and community that the safety and well-being of our students remain our top priority, Baker wrote in an email to New Times. Our schools operate under strict policies and procedures to ensure a safe learning environment for all students. We remain focused on our mission to provide high-quality education and support for the children and families we serve. No other members of the Phoenix Elementary School District No. 1 Governing Board responded to New Times' requests for comment. Bueno already had faced recent criticism from district parents. In January, Parents were upset that the governing board decided to end a lease with ASU Preparatory Academy, which is located just steps away from Xanadu. On March 25th, the board also voted unanimously to close two schools, Paul Lawrence Dunbar Elementary School and the Heard School, because of low attendance and money woes. On February 25th, Booth filed a petition for a recall election of Bueno, citing transparency, accountability, financial responsibility concerns related to school closures, the dismissal of the former superintendent, and the ending of ASU Prep's lease. The revelation of Bueno's connection to Denton has reinvigorated that effort, Booth said. I think she should resign, Booth said. Is this really in the best interest of the community? I don't think so. Bueno is hopeful that her record on the governing board will outweigh parents' concerns. I hope my work and what I do and my service to the community can speak louder than, you know, me being a friend, she said. Remember that if you missed any of the stories in this program or any other Sun Sounds program, you can listen to them on demand. Just go to sunsounds.org and click on Broadcast Info and Audio. Then click on On Demand Podcasts. Scroll down to the program you're interested in and click on Listen. Next, a story written by Morgan Fisher and posted on April 3rd. Will not be erased. Rainbow's Festival holds firm amid Trump's assault. When Phoenix's LGBTQ plus community walks into Heritage Square this weekend, they'll be met with a celebration of the city's queer culture. DJs, musicians, drag queens, and other talents will fill the area for Arizona's greatest street fair, the 23rd annual Rainbows Festival, which Phoenix Pride hosts. It's the second largest annual LGBTQ plus event in the state, behind only the annual Phoenix Pride Festival in October. Some parties you throw to celebrate a love of life. In most of those 23 years, Rainbows has been exactly that. Other parties exhibit a spirit of defiance. A note that this year's Rainbows Fest will strike simply by existing. As some 25,000 people gather in downtown Phoenix to enjoy a weekend of craft cocktails, local food trucks, and more than 150 exhibits and booths, Phoenix Pride organizers are keenly aware of how urgently their community needs a safe space amid rollbacks of LGBTQ rights under the current presidential administration. After President Donald Trump won in November, there was immediate concern about what might be coming, said Jeremy Helfgott, the spokesperson for Phoenix Pride. Despite the federal government's targeting of the LGBTQ plus community, Helfgott said Phoenix Pride is holding firm. This community is not going to be quiet, and this community is going to continue that fight and redouble its efforts in that fight, Helfgott told Phoenix New Times. But it will not be marginalized. It will not be erased. Period. Since Trump won November's election by a scant 1.5% of the popular vote, Phoenix's LGBTQ plus community has braced for a cyclone. Parents of trans kids have created detailed folders full of essential medical and identifying information. Queer teachers have spoken with district lawyers about how to protect themselves from backlash. Families have had roundtable discussions about potentially leaving the country. Now, 2 months into his administration, these Arizonans are in the eye of a storm. The administration slashed federal discrimination protections for LGBTQ plus individuals, leaving community members vulnerable to discrimination based on sexual orientation or gender identity in such government programs as housing, welfare, and employment. The administration has threatened to pull funding from institutions that rely on diversity, equity, and inclusion programs to ensure balance and care in their hiring practices. In turn, many corporations, universities, and local governments have shrunk from the movement, axing their DEI programs and generally marginalizing already marginalized people. Trump has attacked the trans community, which has included funding threats surrounding trans athletes and gender-affirming care for minors under 19, as well as banning transgender people from serving openly in the U.S. Armed Forces. For LGBTQ plus organizations in Phoenix, it has been a moment to come together. Organizations have hosted Know Your Rights workshops, group therapy sessions, community discussions, town halls, and connected others with social service resources. If you're coming out to the party this weekend, you should consider what you too can do to help them ride out the storm. How Phoenix Pride is navigating the moment. Phoenix Pride is continuing to watch the landscape with tremendous vigilance, Helfgott said. That has meant connecting with partners in the public safety world and intelligence space to ensure that our events are safe and secure and proceeding without threat. Security and safety remain a large part of focus. Another is funding. As the Trump administration has widened its crusade against DEI efforts, companies across the country have stepped back from supporting Pride events. Several of San Francisco Pride's biggest past sponsors, including Comcast, Anheuser-Busch, and the beverage company Diageo, aren't providing funding for the event this year. Twin Cities Pride, Hampton Roads Pride, World Pride, and Pride Toronto have also seen corporate funds vanish. For Rainbow's Festival, several national corporations, including Jack Daniels, Sprouts, and Coca-Cola, have continued their sponsorships. Notably, Hensley Beverage Company, whose parent company, Anheuser-Busch, ghosted San Francisco Pride, is a sponsor for this year's event. Another big sponsor for the Phoenix Pride Festival is Amazon, which provides funding through its employee resource group, Glamazon. However, as the company has rolled back diversity programs and initiatives, it's unclear whether Amazon's support for Phoenix Pride will continue. I don't want to guess at how things may evolve, Helfgott said. In the short term, the folks who have supported us have continued to support us, and those relationships are strong. Arizona's lawmakers versus LGBTQ rights. An amount of uncertainty is boiling right under the surface for Phoenix's LGBTQ plus community right now. Trump's strong anti-LGBTQ plus rhetoric and policy actions have also trickled down to Arizona and Phoenix. Republican lawmakers in the Arizona legislature have felt more empowered and emboldened than ever to push anti-trans legislation under the current federal government, Democratic Representative Patty Contreras said. Anti-trans lawmakers believe they have the mandate, Contreras said. And that's kind of scary. This legislation includes bills that would prohibit transgender people from using the bathroom of their choice in schools, ban trans kids from using their preferred pronouns without parental permission, slash medical privacy for trans kids, and ban state programs related to race, gender, or sexuality. Legislators such as Contreras have gotten up on the floor and spoken out against some of these bills, she said. My colleagues have gotten up on the floor and shared their stories. But in a GOP-dominated legislature, Democrats have little power to actually steer legislation. The crackdowns worry Contreras. I'm married to a woman. I've been married for 18 years, she told Phoenix New Times in February. Are they going to not allow me to stay married? Or am I not going to be allowed to go to the hospital and see her if she's in the hospital? For now, LGBTQ plus groups, parents, and legislators are continually thankful for Governor Katie Hobbs' veto stamp to stop scores of horribly toxic, discriminatory, oppressive just awful legislation, Helfgott said. But a future without Hobbs, who is a former Phoenix Pride staffer, is one many don't even want to consider. Outside of the legislature, Trump's influence continues to be felt. Republican Senate President Warren Peterson even traveled to Washington, D.C. to promote the president's anti-trans athlete executive order. And after another Trump executive order, Phoenix Children's Hospital stopped providing gender-affirming care for trans minors. Identities are now being treated as if they should not exist, said Jessica Leach, the CEO of Prisma Community Care, which temporarily shut down their care after the executive order. That blows my mind. As the country enters its third month of the Trump administration, Phoenix's LGBTQ plus community will continue to hold its breath. Each morning's news brings more bleak surprises. Families are forced to consider the possibility that their home state may no longer be safe for them. We're not going to stop doing what we do for the community, Helfgott said. We will not be erased. We will not go away, and we will not stand down. Those sound like fighting words, perhaps, but they also point to one hell of a party. Who is Lori Vallow Daybell? What to know about the Doomsday Cult Mom? This next story was written by Stephen Lemons and posted on March 31st. On March 31st, convicted child killer Lori Vallow Daybell will stand trial in Maricopa County Superior Court for allegedly murdering her fourth husband, Charles Vallow. Dubbed the Doomsday Cult Mom for her bizarre religious beliefs, the former Chandler resident plans to represent herself in what's expected to be a four-week trial before Judge Justin Bareski. The 51-year-old Vallow Daybell also faces a murder charge in the attempted slaying of Gilbert resident Brandon Boudreau, the estranged husband of Vallow Daybell's niece. That count is being tried separately, with the second trial tentatively scheduled to begin May 30th. Here's what to know about Vallow Daybell's infamous crimes, the charges against her, and the unhinged theology she has used to justify her killings. Who is Lori Vallow Daybell? A one-time hairdresser and former Mrs. Texas contestant who once appeared on Wheel of Fortune, Vallow Daybell is currently serving three consecutive life sentences for her involvement in three 2019 murders. One of those killings, or rather two of those killings, were of her own children, 7-year-old Joshua Jason J.J. Vallow and 16-year-old Tylee Ryan. The third person murdered was Tammy Daybell, the 49-year-old wife of cult leader and apocalyptic author Chad Daybell. He and Vallow Daybell married shortly after Tammy was laid to rest. The 56-year-old Daybell is on death row in Idaho after having been convicted in a separate trial of three counts of first-degree murder for the slayings of the two children and his wife. JJ and Tylee went missing in Idaho in September of 2019. 2 months later, their grandparents prompted the police to snoop around. Already married, Daybell and Vallow Daybell fled to Hawaii and refused to cooperate with Idaho cops in finding their missing kids. While living on the island of Kauai, the couple was dogged by reporters asking them if the children were alive. Both declined to answer. In February 2020, Vallow Daybell was arrested and extradited back to Idaho on two felony counts of child abandonment. The bodies of her two children were discovered in June, buried in the backyard of Daybell's home near Rexburg, Idaho. Wearing the same red pajamas seen in the last photo of him alive, JJ's head was covered with a white plastic bag, with his mouth, hands, and ankles bound with duct tape. During Vallow Daybell's 2023 trial, forensic pathologist Dr. Gareth Warren testified that toxicology results for JJ showed trace amounts of alcohol and GHB, the date rape drug. Cause of death, asphyxiation. Tylee's body had been badly burned and dismembered, the remains placed in three separate bags. Her body was in such poor shape that a cause of death could not be determined. This is a homicide. I just can't tell you exactly why, Warren told the court, according to EastIdahoNews.com. Tammy died at home on October 19, 2019. Daybill told police that she had gone to bed with a cough and expired in her sleep. He claimed that his wife had been ill and refused to allow an autopsy of the corpse. Daybill married Lori just 10 days later in Hawaii and reportedly benefited from $430,000 in life insurance policies he'd taken out on Tammy. Tammy's body was later exhumed, and an autopsy was performed, revealing that she had been asphyxiated. Prosecutors claimed the killings were carried out with the help of Valo Daybill's brother, Alex Cox, who died of natural causes on December 12, 2019. Cox's wife later testified that the day before he died, Cox said he was afraid of being the Daybill's fall guy, but would not say for what. All three were members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and part of a Daybill-led group that shared a melange of unorthodox beliefs not sanctioned by the mainstream church. Those beliefs involved reincarnation, end-time prophecies, prepping for Armageddon, and the casting out of evil spirits. They also believed individuals could be rated on a scale of light to dark, with the dark persons possessed by spirits, thereby becoming zombies who must be eradicated. One friend of the group, who testified at Valo Daybill's trial, said Cox completely believed in Chad and Lori, and that JJ, Tammy, and Tylee were all zombies. But in her opening statement at Valo Daybill's trial, prosecutor Lindsay Blake told the jury that what motivated Valo Daybill was hardly spiritual. What she wanted was money, power, and sex, Blake said, according to Deseret News. It didn't matter what obstacle she had to remove to get what she wanted. If it was a person, it didn't matter who. According to the Maricopa County Attorney's Office, there were others Valo Daybill saw as obstacles. Her fourth husband, Charles Barlow, and her niece's then-spouse, Brandon Boudreau. What is Lori Valo Daybill on trial for in Arizona? Maricopa County prosecutors initially indicted Valo Daybill for conspiring with Cox to have Valo and Boudreau murdered, though Boudreau survived the attempt on his life. The charges were later upgraded to premeditated first-degree murder and first-degree murder, respectively. The county attorney's office declined to bring charges against Chad Daybill for the killings, stating that there was no reasonable likelihood of conviction. Valo Daybill was extradited to Arizona in November of 2023 and has pled not guilty to all charges. Valo Daybill was still married to Valo when she met Daybill in October of 2018 at a conference of like-minded doomsday preppers in St. George, Utah, where Daybill was speaking. An ex-grave digger, Daybill had won minor fame in certain radical LDS circles with novels about the impending end times, which would presage a great gathering of Latter-day Saints to build the New Jerusalem. Daybill was smitten by Valo Daybill, and they became lovers. Within months, Valo Daybill's marriage to Valo was foundering. Valo petitioned for divorce, claiming in court paperwork that his life had taken off after draining $35,000 from his bank account. He said his spouse had become infatuated and at times obsessive about near-death experiences and spiritual visions. Believing that she was sealed eternally married to the ancient Book of Mormon prophet Moroni. She also believed that she had been reincarnated several times and was a translated being who cannot taste death, sent by God to lead the 144,000 chosen people spoken of in the Book of Revelations. Where is Jody Vallo-Daybell now? Vallo-Daybell is currently in the custody of the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office and housed in the MCSO's Estrella Jail, an all-women facility. It's the same jail where murderess Jody Arias was housed during her 2013 trial for killing her boyfriend, Travis Alexander. Here's a story written by T.J. LeHeroux and posted on March 31st. GOP lawmaker makes up endorsement to tout run for Secretary of State. The video starts boldly. Seen first only by his feet, GOP State Representative Alexander Kolodin strides confidently away from the Arizona Capitol. As the camera swings in front of him, the Scottsdale Republican announces that he'll be answering the call to run for Arizona Secretary of State in 2026. The second-term lawmaker says he was beckoned into the race by a litany of stakeholders: President Donald Trump, Arizona Republican Party Chair Gina Swoboda, the nebulous future of Arizona, so that he could boot Democrat Adrian Fontes from office and fix Arizona's elections. Arizona elections continue to be a laughingstock under Fontes. Voter confidence is at historic lows, Kolodin wrote in a separate tweet. I'm running for Secretary of State to restore transparency, honesty, security, and lawfulness to our elections. Unfortunately, like so much about Kolodin and how Arizonans vote, his big campaign announcement has some trouble with the facts. In bold text, Kolodin's video claims he was endorsed by Swoboda, whom Trump has credited with helping swing Arizona red in 2024. The video also includes audio and video clips of Swoboda singing Kolodin's praises. Alex Kolodin is going to run for SOS, and I think Alex is amazing, Swoboda can be heard saying. It's immediately followed by a video of Swoboda telling Kolodin, I'd be proud to endorse you, Alex. Despite these clips, Swoboda told Phoenix New Times that he hasn't endorsed him and might actually run against him. I'm considering it hard, Swoboda said in a phone call. She previously worked in the Secretary of State's office when its leader was now Governor Katie Hobbs. Kolodin did not return messages from Phoenix New Times. Swoboda said that she did say those things about Kolodin in his video, but those comments were from December or January. I have said that I would support him if he were the nominee, and I will, obviously, Swoboda told New Times. She noted that the party's bylaws stipulate that she is not allowed to endorse candidates in primaries, a change that followed former Chair Kelly Ward's perceived endorsement of Kerry Lake in 2022. Swoboda said Kolodin frequently sought help or advice from her prior to going rogue with his video, but he never asked her for an endorsement or told her that he was going to jump into the race. Alex Kolodin has asked me for a recommendation for U.S. attorney, Swoboda said. Alex Kolodin asked me if I thought he should run for attorney general, and Alex Kolodin asked me if I thought he should run for SOS. He wanted to do all three, and Alex told me that he would call me before he got in the race to have a conversation with me, because he didn't want to run against me. But somewhere along the way, that must have changed, Swoboda said. Getting off on the wrong foot. Others in the Arizona political landscape immediately piled on Kolodin. On X, former Maricopa County recorder Stephen Richer, who battled the same election lies Kolodin helped to spread, called the video announcement cringe. Richard declined to comment further when contacted by New Times. Via text, Republican public relations consultant Barrett Marson told New Times that Culloden's endorsement screw-up is true to form for him. Culloden does have a dubious reputation, especially when it comes to elections. He was admonished by the State Bar of Arizona for making claims of massive election fraud without providing any evidence. He also represented the Arizona GOP in a lawsuit against Fontes and Maricopa County, claiming Fontes improperly tested voting machines ahead of July's primary elections. However, the party settled the suit after it became clear Culloden and others misunderstood the law. The gangly lawyer-turned-lawmaker has also become well-known for his oddball theatrics in the Arizona House of Representatives. He got crosswise with Maricopa County Attorney Rachel Mitchell, also a Republican, for suggesting that prosecutors killed Gilbert Goon's victim, Preston Lord. Culloden has also pushed laws to make pipe bombs and machine guns legal in Arizona, and to bring back firing squads for state executions. Yet, he has also defied Republican Party convention at times, partnering last year with then-Representative Annalise Ortiz, a Democrat, to co-sponsor a relatively progressive bill that would have allowed criminal defendants to recover attorney fees if they were found not guilty. Even if Culloden were to win the primary, Marson doubts he can beat Fontes. The right wing of the state GOP keeps making the same mistake of running an extreme candidate for statewide office against centrist Democrats and then losing. That happened with Blake Masters and twice with Carrie Lake, and it's poised to happen again with far-right GOP Representative Andy Biggs running for governor against Hobbs. That's why one Democratic insider, who asked to remain anonymous, felt that Culloden's announcement was the best news Adrian Fontes has gotten all week. Marson echoed that thought. If Culloden is the GOP nominee, he said, Fontes will not have to call the moving vans. And that brings us to the end of this week's program. Thanks very much for listening to Stories from the Phoenix New Times. Please stay tuned for additional interesting programs. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer, Chip Hopper.